Welcome to It's Bloody Complicated, the Compass podcast. I'm Neil Lawson, your host and director of Compass. These are unprecedented times, and we need to rise to the new and enormous challenges we now face. Over the next few weeks, we'll be speaking with writers, thinkers, politicians, journalists, and public service workers about how we come out of this mess in much better shape than we went in, a good society after COVID-19. These conversations have live access for Compass members who can put their own questions directly to our guests. If you'd like to participate in the live call and help support all of our work, go to compassonline.org.uk/podcast to join Compass today. Otherwise, sit back, relax, and enjoy this week's podcast. Okay, on this issue of It's Bloody Complicated, we're really delighted to be joined by Dr. Julia Grace Paterson as we celebrate 75 years of the NHS. Julia has a great new book out called Critical, Why the NHS is Being Betrayed and How We Can Fight for It. And there's the book. And I don't know whether you can see me, Julia, holding up your book.
It's just been published
by Mudlark. I strongly recommend that everyone gets a copy of it. It's a brilliant book. It's really well written. I raced through it in a couple of days because, it's not that long, but it's really kind of well written. It's very accessible and tells you everything you need to know about, you know, the problems and why we've arrived at an NHS that's in crisis. And Julia, as we'll hear, was a practicing doctor before she gave up her licence to run the campaigning organisation Every Doctor, a new way of campaigning for the NHS and fighting for staff and patients. So a combination of ideas and action that's super interesting to us and everyone at Compass. We're big fans of Julia and Every Doctor, and we're thrilled to have you on the podcast. Welcome, Julia. So fantastic. So, Julia, we're going to start with, which is where we always do, where are you? And light and honest, how are you?
I'm very well, thank you, Neil. I'm a bit tired because, well, there's a lot of attention on this book at the moment, which is a good thing, but also quite tiring. But horribly, probably a lot of the people in the chat will know this already, but some new information came out about the NHS yesterday through a King's Fund report that shows that we're lagging behind other similar countries to ours in terms of their economies. We're lagging behind in terms of our life expectancy, and there's some pretty well-known stuff in there as well about the fact that we don't have enough staff. I suppose we all knew about that, but it's pretty horrifying, I think, seeing the impact now of all of the cuts to the funding, underinvestment and privatisation that's been going on in recent years. Patients increasingly are becoming aware of all of the problems that are now coming up. And you know, in terms of health, it means that people's health is worsening. There's these incredibly long waiting lists. And unfortunately, and I mean, unfortunately is too mild a word, but people are dying now because of political decisions. And it feels to me, and I'm sure it feels to a lot of the people who are here tonight, politicians are not taking this seriously enough. We're watching the controlled and predicted demise of our public healthcare system. And it's being treated in a sort of, oh, well, sorry, there's no money for it, kind of a way. And it's horrifying to watch. It was very horrifying this winter when things were particularly bad for patients. So sorry, that was a bit long-winded.
No, because this is what you do. You're a campaigner who can't stop talking about the things, the burning passion within you to put this thing right. And I kind of watch you on Twitter and try and follow your progress, which is great. And, you know, the followings you've got and the hits you have. And, I just always think, God, Julia, look after yourself as well as trying to look after everybody else, because you can't burn out because this is going to take a while to do. But you're kind of super energetic. Tell everyone kind of how you got here, how you arrived at this point about, you know, setting up Every Doctor and writing the book. They can understand, yeah, you know, what it was that kind of drove you to be this kind of campaigner and this passionate and this determined.
Yes, yeah, absolutely. So I qualified as a medical doctor in 2010. A few weeks before George Osborne started these austerity cuts. And quite frankly, I wasn't that aware politically when I was a medical student or a young person. I grew up in Jersey. We don't have party politics. I think to a certain extent, people in Jersey live in a bit of a bubble in terms of what's going on in the wider UK. But starting to work in the NHS, it became apparent that as the austerity cuts were coming in, it was impacting on patients. We were losing staff members. And you could see before your eyes, as you moved from one medical job to the next, that problems were emerging, and things that the government was describing as efficiency savings were not efficiency savings. They were actually creating inefficiency. And so I, and I think a lot of other doctors at that point, became more interested politically at what was being done to the NHS. The NHS was always a stressful place to work, but it became harder and harder. And then in 2015, 2016, the junior doctor contract dispute did politicise a lot of doctors, because we were having to work incredibly hard in an underfunded system. And we found that the political messaging that was coming out from the government was misrepresenting us. And I suppose it woke some of us up, quite frankly. We were probably a little bit naive, but it woke us up to the way that they're able to control the messaging in the mainstream media. And it was pretty horrifying to recognise how successfully they were able to do that. And ultimately, a contract was imposed upon junior doctors, which was unfair and which was found through the government's own equality impact assessment to disproportionately impact on women. And so it was pretty awful. And at that point, I had two children in quick succession. And so I had a couple of maternity leaves back to back. I became more involved in campaigning in my spare time, in various grassroots political campaigns. And what became apparent to myself, but not just me, there was a big group of doctors speaking up about this, was that we kept starting campaigns trying to advocate for patients and staff in the wider NHS. And then we would run out of steam, because it's enormously energy impactful, this stuff. And, you know, Neil, and I'm sure loads of other people on this call will have had a similar experience. You start something with a lot of drive, a lot of determination, a lot of energy, and people peter out, because if you're also working and dealing with all the other stuff you've got going on, you know, you just run out of energy. And what was happening is that these campaigns were starting and then diminishing and stopping. And, you know, what we realised is that we needed something more sustainable. And so a group of us built Every Doctor, which is the non-profit campaign organisation that I run now. Over the last couple of years, we've been working very closely with politicians since the pandemic, running mostly parliamentary briefings. We've done over 25 now, and we started in the middle of the pandemic. And during the height of the pandemic, despite all of the horrifying stuff that was going on and the fact that a lot of NHS workers weren't being properly protected, there was a degree of engagement from a large number of politicians across the political spectrum in what we were doing. And we did secure some policy changes to make things better for people. But what we have found over the last year or so is that as Keir Starmer's leadership of the Labour Party have become more organised in their own messaging and their focus on the next general election, we're finding it very difficult to get the political opposition to hold the government to account about problems in the here and now. And it's really scary, because this winter we ran three emergency parliamentary briefings about what was going on the NHS front line. And I'm sure a lot of people will recall, it was a terrifying situation where patients were calling for ambulances that didn't turn up. Some people died as a result. A&E departments were overrun. It was really scary. And in the midst of this, we were bringing frontline senior NHS doctors in contact with politicians in the hope we could lobby for some immediate changes to make things safer. And we found that the degree of engagement from the Labour Party was much less than we had come to expect during the pandemic. And we were receiving a lot of stock responses. When, for example, we would organise for large groups of people to email MPs asking for them to engage with us, we were receiving a lot of the same or almost identical emails that were coming back from MPs' offices. And, you know, I won't be the only one who's had this experience, but essentially, there was central communications coming from the Labour Party, which showed that they were reluctant to get involved in problems in the here and now. They were more talking about what they hoped to achieve beyond the next general election. And I think that's a major problem, because it's one thing for politicians to be looking ahead and planning their own plans for the NHS. But when you've got a situation where patients are dying because they can't access care within the public healthcare system, that requires an emergency response, and we don't seem to have the mechanisms in our political system to force that response to happen. So that's a huge concern, I suppose, of mine.
Yeah, and worryingly, that might, you know, as we get closer to the election, and if there's another crisis in the NHS this winter, then, you know, let's hope Labour are going to be more susceptible to that kind of lobbying and a better reaction to it. Just tell us, I mean, just because it's interesting to know, what, you know, the traditional trade unions in the health sector, you know, obviously the BMA, but others, were they just, you know, you just felt that they weren't representing your interests, you know, as effectively as you could by setting up Every Doctor?
About 5 years ago, when we set up Every Doctor, the trade unions were much quieter and less active. I have a much stronger, more positive opinion about the medical trade unions now than I did 5 years ago. I think they have got a lot better at representing their members. And I mean, obviously, everyone will know that lots of public sector workers have been on strike over the last few months, that there's the sense that they've been listening more to the kind of grassroots elements of the organisations. So I think that's good. But what we try to focus on is systemic problems like privatisation or other safety issues that the trade unions probably aren't focusing on so strongly. And sometimes we will call attention to something and then it will be picked up by a trade union. And so, you know, within any campaigning ecosystem, sometimes you'll have one group speaking up about something first, and then it will get picked up by one of the larger trade unions. And that's what we find often does happen. You know, so we don't directly collaborate with the BMA, for example, but there's been times where we've spoken up about something and then they've spoken up about the same thing. And having a number of organisations speaking up about the same thing obviously does lend an element of strength to it, doesn't it? So,
yeah. Good. Well, that sounds like something constructive has come out of that. And that's really good to hear. So there's another wave of junior doctor strikes coming up. Do you want to, you know, what are they about? And what's likely to happen?
There is, yeah. And I don't know, people might know this already, but we've just had the news about the consultant strike ballot as well, which has just come back positive for today. So consultants are now going to be going on strike as well within July, which is, I mean, that's the first time I think that's ever happened. It's definitely a real sea change in the sort of the feeling amongst consultants. I mean, consultants have endured a massive real terms pay cut. It's been 34.9% cut from their pay since 2008, 2009. But for a long time, they just kept putting up with it, basically, and putting up. But they absorbed an awful lot of pressure and stress during the pandemic. And since coming out of the pandemic, the government has been very reticent to do anything to support the senior doctors who are, you know, shouldering a lot of the burden. And I think the stress levels of doctors across the board now is just sky high. And as well as strike action, so like you said, the junior doctors are going to be taking 5 continuous days of strike action, which is obviously extremely long, and the consultants are going to take a couple of days. There's also just a lot of unrest and unhappiness and hundreds of NHS staff leaving every single week at the moment. And I think what's really awful, Neil, is that the government could be stopping all of this. They could be stepping in and negotiating, but they're so reluctant to do it that in itself drives down staff morale, because there's this sense that the staff aren't valued. And that's, you know, that's a difficult thing to absorb, I think, when you're working in the public sector.
You know, my heart goes out to, you know, all of those people and, you know, the wonderful job they're doing, and to be treated like that. Let's turn to the book, shall we? So, you know, I've experienced it as well. Writing a book is really hard, and publicising it is even harder, isn't it, Julia, as you're now finding out? You thought the easy bit was done.
Yes.
But it wasn't. So, Conan, why did you want to write the book, and just take us through, you know, the core elements of it, not so that people can use, and that's just a summary for everyone to go and buy it, not to think that they've heard it because they've heard some of it from Julia. So why I want to write the book, and I presume it's your first book?
It is my first book, yes. And the reason I wanted to write it is because I speak to a lot of people online every day about the problems in the NHS, both staff and patients. And there's poor reporting in the media at the moment in terms of the kind of long-term reasons why the problems in the NHS have occurred. there's a lot of attention paid to crises in the minute when, for example, an ambulance doesn't turn up somewhere, or there's a horrific human tragedy that they can report on, or some snapshot of information about a waiting list or a strike or something. But I think people struggle to get the sense of the big picture because the media aren't really reporting on it in a way that shows the sort of analysis and scrutiny that we might hope of politicians' decision over time. And I think in a climate and an environment like that, unfortunately, because a lot of people are now being failed by our public healthcare system, they're being led to conclusions about things like this model isn't working, we need to have a new healthcare model, or perhaps we should privatise it all because I can't get through to my GP, or perhaps it's my GP's fault because I'm trying to call them and I can't get through on the phone. And in that situation, some politicians and media outlets are very cannily pointing the fingers of blame at people who haven't caused the problems in the first place, like NHS staff and sometimes patients as well, you know, who are accused of being a bit entitled or not being patient enough, this sort of thing. The reality is that we have a healthcare system now which is in collapse, and it's in collapse because of political decisions. And unless we can understand the causes of this and why it's happening, we're not going to be able to push for its restoration. So I wanted to create an accessible book. And like you say, Neil, it's not very long, but it provides an explanation as to where we are now and what the problems are, what the key things are that politicians would need to reverse in order to restore our public healthcare system. Because, Neil, the thing is, you know, a lot of campaigners are left-wing, and the trade unions obviously have a sort of leanings towards the Labour Party traditionally, et cetera, et cetera. But the reality we have right now is that the vast majority of the public, regardless of who you vote for, want the NHS to survive. And yet, neither of the two major political parties are putting forward the proposals we need to rebuild the service. And so it's going to come down to the public pushing for what we want and, you know, putting politicians under pressure to do those things. And all of those things are expensive, so they're always very reticent to put the money up front. But that's where I think we are. And so I'm hoping this book can spread awareness about what's going on and sort of empower people to speak up themselves or share it around with other people as well.
And I think it does that. It does give you, it's a kind of campaigning toolbook in a sense, isn't it? Because it gives you chapter and verse on the problems, why the problems have, you know, occurred. And then, you know, at least a big chunk of the stuff about what the solutions are. We might come back to that in a bit. Why do you think, you know, why is it the NHS is so, you know, my dad, Nigel Lawson, he's not really my dad, I lied about that. I mean, his famous quote was, it's the nearest thing that Britain has to a national religion, isn't it?
Yeah,
you know, why is that? It's got to be something to do with its kind of basically essential socialist, you know, foundations. And because it's more socialist than anything the 45 government did, because it is free at the point of use. There is no conditionality whatsoever, is there? I mean, although that's creeping in and you can talk about that, but people love it because they just know it's there for them, don't they?
I think this is what it's all about, really, Neil. It's an extraordinary institution, and politicians manage to reduce it into talking about this budget or that budget, or we don't have enough money right now, and curtailing plans, and you know, limiting this and limiting that. If you think about the service and why people love it, it's because it underpins care within our society, which is an incredibly powerful thing. And it's one of the great levelers in our society, which has pushed us forward, enabled progress, lengthened life expectancy, enabled research. It's built us in ways beyond our health. You know, if you think about the impact of having a healthy population, the benefits are far beyond health. You know, it helps with our economy, it helps with our happiness, it helps with reducing mental health problems. And all of those things are incredibly meaningful to people. That there are so few parts of our welfare state that function properly or even exist anymore, because so much has been pulled away now. And the NHS, I mean, everybody has a story, if not relating to their own health, but someone that they love in a vulnerable moment has relied upon this service and it's delivered what they need. And that's not true in a lot of other healthcare systems around the world. And I think people are quite aware of that and feel this incredibly innate sense that this is part of what it is to be British, to be honest. I mean, it really has become part of our identity, I think.
And as Andy's saying in the chat, though, I mean, it can't be beyond constructive criticism, can it? And I just kind of like, so, I mean, I think you're absolutely right, and the book's absolutely right, that so much of this is down to political football, lack of investment, you know. But it's also the thing, because you've worked in it, and I don't understand it. I've looked at it a bit and thought about the, you know, the structures of health from certain perspectives. But having worked in it, it's a 19. It's like a deformed 1948 construct, which is very centralized, very Fordist, very uniform, very top down, and then has been kind of, you know, changed and adapted, not in helpful ways, by, you know, salami slice, you know, commercialization, lack of investment, etc. But if you were going to invent the NHS today in, you know, 2023, you wouldn't do it like 1948, would you? How can we talk about reform without that being a code for commercialization, but being a basis for a genuine conversation about all of the stakeholders within it, about how you have a 21st century, you know, socialist health service?
I think so. All of this is really, really important. Obviously, the healthcare system does, you know, has to have constructive conversation about how to improve it. The way I talk about it in the book, and this is how I've come to think about this health service, is that it has three core principles that underpin what this project is meant to fulfill. It's meant to provide comprehensive care, free care, and equal care. And a public healthcare project is never going to be a static project, because those things are meaty, difficult, intangible concepts within any society to achieve. There will always be people on the fringes of society. There will always be people living in poverty or who don't have enough. But if you try to build a healthcare system where those things are the things you are aiming for, you will construct a thing in the shape of the society you are trying to provide care for. And I think what the problems are at the moment is that those three things have been lost sight of. And as you say, Neil, we now have a situation where reforms have been put in place one after the other, poorly thought through, poorly executed, with huge inefficiency in some areas. I mean, you've only got to look at the amount of work that goes into tendering these private contracts to look at that. That's money that's footed by the public taxpayer, you know. But there's so much inefficiency, like you say. And I think what we need to do now, the public, is to have that important conversation 75 years on from its inception, where we ask ourselves, you know, what is it we want from this public healthcare system? Are those three principles still the things we want to have at the core? I believe they are, Neil, because I've looked at a lot of polling and it does seem that the public do value that enormously. But if that is the case, how are we going to structure a thing that's going to work, that will be fit for the future, that has the right tech, that reaches people where they want to receive their healthcare? And also that we'll be able to adapt as we move into the future, because people's healthcare expectations and our research also changes all the time. And so any idea that we could just build X number of hospitals and everything would be perfect, we would never, ever achieve that goal. It's got to be a changing project. And I think a project like that, of that sort of enormity, is only ever going to work if the principles are the core and at the centre, and that people are held to account via those principles. As soon as you introduce anything else, like, for example, profit making, which is what has been introduced in various ways, you introduce a new motive, and that motive is pulling the plans for the NHS away from those three things.
And just to pick up on one bit of that, just the equality bit, not because we don't believe in equality, but we kind of believe in democracy and participation. And, mm-hmm. and if we were to think about devolving power within the NHS to frontline staff, to patients, to doctors, to everyone, because they know a lot of things best, we're going to get some different, processes and institutions and outcomes and goals. So that idea that it's the same everywhere, do you not think that's going to be hard to maintain? And that through difference, people are going to be learning from different things and then applying, and we could get a kind of, you know, a virtuous cycle built up. But it doesn't mean to say that everything's the same everywhere, or do we have to hang on to that principle because it's health and life and that's different?
I think there's a few things there. So I think that politicians with no healthcare background have too much say and too much power at the moment over what goes on. And they don't involve patients and clinicians enough in decision making. So if there are centralized decisions, I think they need to listen a lot more to the experts and also to the service users, wherever those might be. I think locally, what has happened, because there has been such breakage into tiny fragments of the NHS, there is a disparity in health across the country, and there's a postcode lottery. Some of that is because of debt that certain NHS trusts have and some don't. Some of it is because, depending on what population you fall within, you might have different healthcare services offered to you on the NHS because of the way the model currently works. Like, for example, fertility treatment differs around the country depending on population. But there's a problem at the moment, Neil, where they're breaking the NHS into its component parts. And then each of those component parts is not having enough involvement from the clinicians and from lay people. So at the moment, the Health and Care Act 2022 broke the NHS in England into 42 parts. They're called integrated care systems. And they're essentially boards. And the boards at the moment don't have enough input from clinicians. And so we've got stupid stuff going on. I heard from a doctor the other day who said she's in charge of a haematology service locally, and they're setting up a new system and they didn't have any of the right equipment because the people in charge of the budget have bought the wrong stuff and the wrong room and the wrong chairs. And it's things like that, Neil. I mean, there are differences locally. There's always going to be a need, I think, to listen to a local population, work out what your patients need. But if you've got the wrong people even making decisions about where the money goes, you've got no hope, have you?
I don't think so. No. So some combination of those two. So look, just as we begin to wind up, and then Harry brings in some of the questions from the members, and do put any more in. I can see there's a bunch in there, some good questions. But if anyone's got any more, get them in now. So two last ones. And the first one is, I mean, just spell out to us, you know, I mean, not just Labour, but, you know, we'd probably, you know, we'll get shot for it, but we'd probably quite like a Labour-led government of some sort involving Liberal Democrats and Greens and other, you know, other progressives. Mm. What's the top line of what you want to see from any change of government?
I think the most immediate concern that we have in the NHS right now relates to the workforce, because if you think about those enormous waiting lists, we have the longest on record. There's 7.4 million patients in England alone waiting for treatment, and this is the summertime. It's going to come into a crisis again in the winter. We need to support the staff because the staff are leaving in their droves, right? We need to pay them properly. We need to make sure they're getting their annual leave. We need to provide proper mental health support for people who've endured an awful lot of stress and trauma. That would be my number one. I think they need to pay off the PFI debt, which remains on lots of hospitals around the country, because in case anyone listening doesn't understand that, it's the private finance initiatives that were entered into a long time ago, mostly during the Blair era, but it's lumbered some NHS trusts with such enormous debt to pay off the leases on their buildings that they're paying out per year more than their medicines bill just to pay off the interest on these leases, which is an appalling situation. They need to sort that out because it will level the playing field a bit. And personally, Neil, I feel like they need to reverse all of the outsourcing going on in the NHS, because I don't know how many people have seen this, but there was a study that came out in The Lancet last year where The Lancet had been looking at the private outsourcing that had been going on between 2013 and 2020. They concluded that it had been continuously increasing, and they looked at any patient harm that had been caused by the situation. And they found that there was a statistically significant increase in excess deaths caused in areas that had more outsourcing to private companies. That's a really stark and terrifying statistic to have come out in one of the best medical journals in the world. And politicians are just ignoring it and carrying on. And, you know, when we think about a Labour government, they've been, I mean, Wes Streeting and Starmer have been going to the papers and talking about their proposed involvement of private sector and partnerships. I think we would be a little bit naive to think we wouldn't need to use the private sector at all if we're going to be clearing these waiting lists. I do think they probably need to be used in the short term. But from what I can see, Starmer and Streeting aren't telling us we're going to be using them for X amount of time. It's just for this specific thing, then we'll stop. It all seems a bit open-ended to me, and I'm concerned that yet more money is going to get funneled into the private sector at the expense of, you know, funding what we could be doing with the public service.
Well, let's hope you can keep campaigning on that, and we'll support you. Last one from me, and I didn't tell you I was going to ask you this one, but it just jumped into my head as you were talking about the kind of consensus we need for a long-term new settlement for the NHS. I mean, you know, so over here in Compass Towers, we're very big on proportional representation because we think there's a progressive mm-hmm. majority in this country, and that progressive majority could, you know, impact on, you know, what government we've got for a long period of time, you know, mm-hmm. and be based on that progressive majority, not, you know, watching Starmer go and, you know, kneel before Murdoch at his summer party at the weekend, because that's the way he thinks the route to power is. You know, we think the route to power is having an electoral system which mobilises that progressive majority so that you can invest in long-term, institution building or rebuilding like the NHS. Does that ever kind of, you know, does that issue ever kind of cross your mind? And do you have any thoughts on that?
On a personal level, I completely agree, Neil. You know, you see these charts, don't you, about what the spread of votes are and you know, in a way, it's quite a hopeful thing to see. On the other hand, it's incredibly frustrating, isn't it, given that we don't have proportional representation at the moment and, you know, unclear if we're going to achieve that in the future. But yeah, I think there are more and more people, I think, waking up to the idea that that's important. And I think personally, that's fantastic. We're not going to come up with a long-term plan from the NHS, I don't think, if we just leave it to one political party and expect them to come up with some kind of magical plan, because they're proving that's not going to happen. And during the pandemic, something that actually was incredibly positive, I found, was that the fact that it was an emergency meant that there was cross-party working in various ways, which was enormously positive. Yeah. There were groups of politicians working together in ways they wouldn't normally. And, you know, we were seeing it because they were writing letters together or they were organising to ask questions in Parliament or whatever. But it felt like everyone put down their weapons for a bit and just worked together and did good work. And I wish it were more like that all the time. I know perhaps that comes across slightly naive, but when you've got a situation where people are suffering, and there are so many people suffering in our country right now, you would just hope that politicians could work together for a common good.
Yeah, our adversarial system, tribal system, doesn't allow that. But that's, we'll do the PR bit, you do the NHS bit, and then between us, you know, we'll sort everything.
Hello, Samuel here from the Compass office. I hope you're enjoying the discussion so far. It's Bloody Complicated is brought to you by Compass, and it's made possible by the support of our amazing members, like Eliza. Here's Eliza on why she joined the Compass community.
My name is Eliza. I've been a Compass member for about 3 or 4 years, I think. What drew me to Compass was the fact that it's cross-party and it's also not a party. I had a light bulb moment about elections, which was no one's going to win except the Tories under this system, and we have to work together. Having been previously a member of the Labour Party and then joining the Green Party, I really wanted to see parties working together, and we have people that are politicians, MPs, trade union leaders, etc. And it's quite level. There's no big hierarchy. It's quite an honest, open space where people come together. You will hear from people from all around the political spectrum actually debating the hard stuff. It's actually, let's find a solution to the problems that we have and let's do it together. We need this progressive alliance. And I would like to see people who are passionate about getting the Tories out in the next election and getting proportional representation in. Come and join Compass now and actually swell the movement, because without people, there's no power. And that's what we need right now.
Find out more about joining the Compass community at compassonline.org.uk/podcast. And now, back to the discussion.
Harry, I've grabbed Julia's attention for too long. Over to you and some great questions for our members. Thank you.
Right. So first we have Tony and then Iski. So I'm going to bring in Tony first and then I'll bring in Iski and then I'll hand over to you, Julia, to answer the questions.
Okay. So what's occurred to me often about what's going on in the NHS at the moment, that reminded me, what I put in the Q&A, that the standard way to close a railway line was to reduce the service to maybe what used to be called parliamentary trains, sort of one train a day at a time when nobody wants to use it. It's going on at the moment on the Esk Valley line up in Whitby, if you read the magazines. And then they look at the service and say, well, nobody's using it, so we might as well close it. And it looks very much to me that, you touched on this a little, that's what's happened with dentistry. It's got to the point where private facilities are either, where NHS facilities are simply not available, so people are going private. And the trend is therefore for our dentistry to be private rather than NHS. Is there actually a malign influence at work here doing this deliberately rather than simply neglect or not knowing what they're doing?
I mean, I used to hope, I guess, that that wasn't the case and really try to approach this in, you know, in the manner that we probably all do, thinking, let's look at all the facts, work out what's going. Is it incompetence? Is any of this intentional? Is it simply they don't have enough money? I think what's really awful now is that there is the sense that healthcare access is being reduced from lots of people within our society, and more people are, in inverted commas, turning to private healthcare. But they're not really turning to private healthcare. They're paying for the public healthcare system through their taxes. They're then not able to access what they need through the public system. And lots of people, it's 1 in 8 people, I think, last year had to use private healthcare. Lots of people wouldn't choose to, but they've been pushed into that situation, often through going into debt or borrowing money or, you know, awful situations. Because as you say, the public system simply is not functioning in a way that it should be. And then, as you say, then at some point, you imagine that they're going to throw up their hands and say, this system simply isn't working anymore. Let's just get rid of it because it's useless and it's rubbish. And I feel like that's happening right now. I think what's really awful is that when you read the papers about this, they focus a lot on waiting lists. And the sense is that it's a sort of passive thing to be on a waiting list and that you just have to be patient and get, you know, wait for your turn. But the reality for patients is it's not like that. If you're on a waiting list for over a year, you might become dependent on a medication. You might develop other symptoms. You might develop a mental health problem or lose a job or, you know, it's really terrible stuff. And so this situation, which I suspect is happening in the way that you're describing, is being made out to be a sort of passive occurrence that isn't impacting on people's health. But the reality is that it's impacting on lots of people's quality of life. And that's what makes me really cross. I think as a doctor, like quite often in these interviews, I start crying because the stories I hear from patients and staff are just so heartbreaking and so terrible. And it makes me always think that the people really who the NHS was set up for wasn't the people who could go and pay for a private operation. You know, it was for the people who are really vulnerable in our society, who have no other option. And these articles at the moment about how people are turning to private healthcare in inverted commas, they never focus on the people who can't turn to private healthcare. Sorry, I've really gone on a ramble there, but it upsets me a great deal.
Thanks, Julia. I'll just bring in Iski to ask that question now.
Hi, Iski.
Hi, Julia. I think the analysis that you made is very good indeed and very accurate. I worked in the health service for over 30 years. And I think that I'd like to start by saying that the NHS needs more money, a great deal more money for adequate staffing at all levels, as well as capital investment. The NHS in the 1990s got an extra 2% funding. In the 2000s, it got an extra 5% funding. From 2011 to 2019, the funding went to minus 0.2%, which shows you how much money is needed, not only for catch up, but to get ahead. Mm-hmm. However, we will never improve health of the nation without investing in the social determinants of health, housing, jobs, food, education, which will improve the health. So the question to you, or my statement to you, is do you agree that for every pound spent on health, NHS and care, there should be £3 spent on the social determinants of health?
I think, I don't know the exact figures, so I think I would struggle to say what the quantity of money would need to be, but I absolutely agree with you that these things do not exist in isolation, do they? I mean, thank you so much for working in the NHS for so long. I'm sure that patients, you know, valued your work so highly. It's so difficult, and you can't tease one thing out from another. I think the way that we've been recently thinking about health or any of the other aspects of our society in this sort of capitalist way is that you can isolate one thing and put a price tag on it. But that's not the way a society works. If we really are interested in creating a system where we provide a welfare state or some kind of a safety net beneath people, all of the things are linked up. Education, as you say, public health, transport, the access to a library, all of these things. And I think we need to pay so much more attention to people's general well-being. But it's very difficult at the moment, isn't it, to have that conversation, because things have been pulled back so much, as you say, that even getting ourselves back to some kind of a steady state would it require a lot of investment. And when I've been doing some of these interviews, I've been hit with the question, well, won't that cost a lot? You know, and of course, all of these things will, because like you say, because the investment has been starved for so long, it's going to cost an enormous amount of money to try and rebuild any of this. I think what I've been trying to say, and this, I guess this is the last thing I'm going to say here, is there's a lot of talk about cost and there's not a lot of talk about value. And I think the public needs to be asked, what are the things in society that you value the most? And politicians should be held to spending public money on those things instead of just spending public money on whatever it is they've decided to. It just as one tiny example of this, this year, NHS England is going through a branding exercise because it's deemed that they don't have a good public image and they're spending public money on that. And in 2022, NHS England spent £83 million on management consultants. And I mean, that £83 million could have done so much good somewhere else. I think, we've got to do so much of a better job, I think, about telling politicians where the money needs to go. Sorry, that's all I'm going to say there. Thank you, Ishki.
Thanks, Julia. We've got a couple more questions from Judy and Andy. So we're bringing in Judy first. Hi, Judy.
Hi, Julia. Thank you so much for everything that you're doing. It's great. And actually, I think my question follows on a wee bit from Iski's, and certainly some of the things that you were saying in response to Ishki. I was just wondering about, you know, trying to kind of change the narrative a bit, because it strikes me that when we think of the health service being free at the point of service, it kind of makes it sound a bit like it's a charity and something that we should be grateful for. Rather than a system that we have each of us funded according to our means. And it's not something that I would normally suggest, that we kind of try to take on a consumerist culture, because I hate it. But maybe if we were to stand up for ourselves and to change the narrative into more something like, we've paid for this, it's our right to have it. Do you think that might help?
Yes, I think so. I definitely think so, because there's been a couple of occasions recently where senior politicians have spoken about charging NHS patients. For example, Sajid Javid wants them to be charged in GP and A&E when they attend, and Rishi Sunak wants to charge patients if they miss an appointment. And sometimes when this is spoken about in the media, it is lost, Judy, that people have already paid. It's not free. It's paid for by the taxpayer. And I think it's terrible. And I completely agree with what you're saying. I talk about this in the book quite a lot, actually, about how politicians manage to sort of wave this public service around and show their allegiance by, for example, wearing an NHS badge or something and looking fantastic, telling us all that they love it. And what gets lost with all of that is that the NHS isn't theirs to sort of wave around. It's a system that they have been given custodianship over, and they hold a responsibility to the patients and the staff. And we very rarely see them holding that responsibility and acting appropriately. It, And that gets under my skin a bit, because I think if you've been an NHS staff member, you recognise the enormous responsibility that staff hold and how accountable they are to their patients. And it feels like the government aren't accountable in the same way, and yet they're the ones holding the purse strings.
Right. Thanks, Julia. I'm just going to bring in Andy now.
Hi, I'm an optometrist, so in one of those other primary care professions. And the sort of question that I'd submitted was really, it's a sort of do you agree that type of question, that the NHS isn't just about hospitals and primary care isn't just about GPs. It's making sure that we integrate the dentists, the pharmacists and the optometrists in, and we do it on a sensible basis that's the same throughout the country, because people's eyes, teeth and everything else is the same. So there's a vast number of services that are commissioned locally. You know, in eye care, which I know about, you know, we have a general ophthalmic service, basic NHS sight test. Then some GP practices are in areas, ICBs, where they commission extra services, some don't. So a sort of a comment on that. And listening to the other conversations that we've had, the whole point of whether we can afford things is sort of somewhat muddied by this analogy that the national economy is a bit like a household. You can't spend more than you've got. We only got the taxation. 99%.org, Mark E. Thomas's book, which I think Neil's well aware of, makes the point that as a sort of sovereign country with a sort of international currency, we can create, the government can create money. I think we should be making sure that we do prioritise having a good health service as one of the things to create money for. And do you agree with that?
Yes, I know, Mark, actually. We've been writing, well, they've written a report and we've been sort of endorsing the report, but there's a new report they've written about the NHS and its you know, importance in society and to our economy. And I completely agree with what you're saying. I think those wider questions of being able to afford things, in inverted commas, are really, really important, especially, I mean, if any of us wrote down on a piece of paper things that the government has spent money on in recent years, which somehow they have been able to afford, and they haven't been able to afford, you know, basic stuff in the NHS, it makes the argument seem silly when you think about how much money they waste on lots of other things. But it's difficult. It draws you up short, doesn't it? Because it closes a conversation off to a lot of people who don't understand the economy and how it works, and I'm no expert. It feels like that's a finite answer, and it's not, like you say. And if we did invest in health and create money like you're suggesting, then it would probably pay us back in dividends in terms of the impact on our society.
Thanks, Julia. I'm just going to bring in Frieda now.
I know it takes a very long time to train doctors and nurses, but because we seem to have such a huge shortage at the moment, why are not more being trained? Is it because we don't have the capacity to train more?
Well, this has been a question that the medical community have been asking a lot recently, because it doesn't seem like it makes a lot of sense. There was actually something in the last year or so where it looked like the government could have expanded places at medical school and then they didn't. And to be honest, I don't think anyone received the answers they needed there, because you're quite right, it would be a long-term plan that would really, really help. But Rishi Sunak has just come up with a plan which is nonsensical, but I mean, would achieve some numbers in his mind, where he's talking about taking school leavers and introducing what he's calling NHS apprenticeships. Apparently, sort of lots, thousands and thousands of students are going to be trained up as apprenticeship roles in the NHS as doctors and nurses. But what's difficult with that, instead of doing it the traditional way where people go to universities and have the expertise of, you know, lecturers, etc., is that we don't currently have the workforce to support apprenticeships like that. The idea is a good one, but you need experienced patient staff to help people through those processes, and we just don't have the staff at the moment, and so none of it's properly thought through. I guess we would all hope that in the long term that workforce plan is put together, because you probably know this already, but lots of our staff at the moment are training in the UK and then moving to another country where they know they'll be better supported, and it's an awful situation. We're hemorrhaging these experienced people who have have worked within our service and then they're leaving because it's an awful place to work at the moment.
Thanks, Julia. I'm just going to bring in Kerry.
Hi. I think you've touched on this already, but I wondered how you felt about, in the last sort of couple of years, we've moved over from clinical commissioning groups to integrated care boards. And I just wondered what your view on that, whether that's actually improved anything or just moved the problem elsewhere.
It's quite early to say at the moment. I mean, there were problems with the clinical commissioning groups, as you probably already know, Kerry, but the worry from lots of campaigners was that this move to an ICS system, this is for anyone who isn't aware of this, England was broken up into these 42, they're called integrated care systems, and they're run by these things called integrated care boards. That's the latest sort of NHS reform that happened last year. There was a real concern, and the concern, you know, continues, that it's going to enable more private outsourcing locally. And the reason for that is that when they were put in place, the government was using language like, this is going to remove bureaucracy in awarding contracts. And it was raising a lot of alarm bells, because for a lot of people, that word bureaucracy actually meant proper process. So that's a huge concern. And the other thing that I've heard, Kerry, which is a concern, is that there isn't enough clinical representation on these integrated care boards. There's also people, and again, this is a sort of not really sure because there's no evidence of it yet, but it kind of makes sense kind of a thing, where some people are worried that this ICS system has been built in this way because it mirrors the way that American healthcare is delivered, and that they've cunningly devised this plan so that these local areas with boards are going to mirror a healthcare insurance system like the ones in the States, and it will smooth the process of politicians telling us we're going to change things now, we're moving to an insurance system, you know, these boards are going to run each of the local areas. That is certainly being said in the campaigning community, but, you know, it's early days for that, yes, I would say.
Thanks, Julia. I think we have time for one more, which I'm going to read out from Peter. The question is, maybe you could say a word about the effect of the NHS on loss of freedom of movement. Should we be taking a stand on this?
I suppose, Peter, do you mean in terms of our citizens' freedom of movement elsewhere? Sorry, I don't really understand the question.
Yeah, super. Well, I'm talking about the loss of huge numbers. The Nuffield Foundation estimates 4,000 doctors who would be working in the NHS if it hadn't been for the fact that the door was shut to EU nationals. Now, I know some have been allowed to stay. And it does, you're quite right, it does work both ways, because, of course, people in Britain are suffering equally. But I'm particularly interested in the NHS and the effect that this phenomenon is having on staffing.
Yes, Peter, I haven't seen a good report that's been done about this, actually, in terms of stats, but I speak to a lot of doctors and other healthcare workers online, and anecdotally, you're absolutely right. There have been loads of examples of people who have come to the UK, often who've made a home and have lived in the UK for a number of years, either for their training and then staying, or coming after they've qualified elsewhere and then come to the UK. And they have then left in the last 5 years or so. I know lots of examples of people who've left to go often to a European country, either where their home, their original home was, or where they just know they're going to have better quality of life and feel more welcomed. And quite a lot of that, when you talk to people about it, isn't so much that they got kicked out in, you know, whatever date when Brexit came in. It was more this sense that they weren't welcome anymore. And I've heard from more and more doctors recently that, you know, some of the messaging in the press, which is sort of anti-NHS staff and blaming them for problems, is pushing people who were maybe already considering going, you know, it's pushed people out the door. And so I think it's an unquantified number of people, Peter, who you're right, have gone because of either an actual, you know, limitation in their movement that's guided by law, or just this general sense that the UK isn't the place for them anymore and they're not welcome here. And that's awful, I think.
Look, we've run out of time, and that was just absolutely fantastic, Julia. And I think everyone could have listened to just, the calmness and the rational way that you talk about this stuff is just so important. So keep behaving in that way, be passionate, but you're kind of rational, calm, this is sensible, it's the right thing to do, is exactly the way to campaign. And, you know, it's been brilliant to hear you, and we're so grateful. The next podcast will be at 6 p.m. on Tuesday, the 11th of July, when we'll be digging into the book, another book, Free and Equal, with the author, Daniel Chandler. And that's all about how we might reclaim the ideas of John Rawls to win a good society. So please make sure that you tune in then. But more people are going to buy Julia's book than Daniel's book, because that's the right thing to do. Until then, thanks again, Julia, for being on the call tonight and for all you do. Everyone, buy the book. Thanks, Harry, for looking after us all, as ever. And thanks to you all on the call tonight. If you're listening to the podcast later in the week and want to join next time but haven't joined us yet, please do so. We need you to win a good society, and everyone needs a compass to navigate these complex times. Until then, keep hopeful, keep determined, and look after yourself. And good night, everyone. It's been lovely to share some time with you.
So, if you like what you've heard today and want to be part of a much more equal, democratic and sustainable future, a good society, then visit us at compassonline.org.uk/podcast, and you'll be able to join us live on future calls just like this one. You can tweet me at Neil, N-E-A-L, underscore compass, or compass at compass office. And if you've enjoyed this week's episode, please give us a rating. It will help us reach more listeners in the future. And it's only fair that they know it's bloody complicated too.